From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in December of last year with a study on breast cancer screenings. The research saying that women who've had false positive mammogram results may be at increased risk of developing breast cancer. And that suggests, well, a number of things, and it's easy to get confused about what it means. We're going to work through that this hour. People have asked, well, does that mean that prior false positive screenings might be useful in risk prediction models, perhaps? And as we learn more about what cancer is and how not all breast cancers are created equally, the imaging technology becomes capable of finding smaller and smaller cancers. And you've probably heard what the critics say. Some say, well, that can be all good, but sometimes you scare women into treating cancers that are so small and non-aggressive that we're making perfectly well people into cancer patients. Is that fair? Well, this hour, let's talk about these questions. Let's answer your questions on guidelines, mammogram screenings, when you should, when you shouldn't start. All of that. We're going to work through that with two guests who we talk to regularly on these programs, whether you listen to Connections, Second Opinion Live. You've seen Dr. Lou Papa there, primary care physician at the Center for Primary Care, Olson Medical Group, and a professor of clinical medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Papa, nice to have you back here.
Thanks, Evan. It's good to be back.
And Dr. Avis O'Connell is the director of women's imaging and a professor of imaging sciences at the University of Rochester Medical Center. And Dr. O'Connell, great to have you as well.
Thank you.
All right, so I'm confused. And I'm always confused. I mean, I don't mean to be flippant here, but I do know, and Avis, we've talked about this plenty over the years, it does sort of feel like every 6, 12 months or 1 or 2 years, we get either new guidelines from a different source. So that can be confusing. And then when we talk about what is a false positive, what is it not, what does it mean, that can be confusing. So the newest research, false positives, to you, what's the takeaway? What's the news?
Right. Well, this recent study showed that women who'd had a false positive, either in image, there are two kinds of false positives. One is you get a mammogram and a callback and an extra picture or ultrasound is taken and there's nothing there. That's a false positive imaging. That's a short false positive. It's just 10 minutes or a second visit, whatever. The other false positive is a biopsy. So we see some calcifications or an asymmetry or a mass. We do a biopsy and good news, it comes back benign. That's also called a false positive. That's a false positive biopsy. It wasn't cancer. So a friend of mine recently said, you know, false positive sounds like something terrible, but it's actually good news. So from my perspective, I say, and I know there's a worry involved, and I'm certainly not underplaying that, but if somebody comes in and we do an additional view and an ultrasound and we go in and tell them, you know what, that was nothing overlap or it was something benign, they're very happy. That's good news. But that is also categorized as a false positive when we keep statistics.
All right. So before we continue to dig deeper into what the study is telling us, Dr. Papa,
right.
You know, when you, as somebody in primary care now,
right.
When it comes to false positives,
right.
is a false positive a good thing?
I mean, I guess in the end, it's a relief, but from a societal point of view, it's not a good thing because it means you're, at a minimum, you're scaring individuals. You know, I know my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer and she's had some false positive scans in the past, and it's terrifying. But also from a cost point of view, it's very costly. False positives are costly. They require additional imaging. They require biopsying. They require pathology review. So that in some respects, there's no way you'll get away from false positives. There's no such thing as a perfect test. But from a point of view, they're not good from an operational point of view.
All right. So Avis, this
right.
is your chance to punch back a little bit.
But then what would you have us do? So the woman walks in and they expect to know, do I have cancer or not? Are we going to look at a grouping of calcifications that could so easily, I could biopsy two identical groups of calcium. One will come back benign fibrocystic, the other will come back early cancer. And when I walk in to say to the person, look, you do have some calcifications, whereas the great majority, like 80% of those will come out benign. We can watch these or we can biopsy them. Almost every woman says, please biopsy them. And so then the majority which come back benign, they're very relieved. But that is a false positive.
Right.
And so depending on women's tolerance for that anxiety, I think is the discussion. Now, there are some women and they say, no, if you don't need to do a biopsy, I'm okay with that. I'll come back in 6 months. So it's up to the individual women. And I really welcome the joint decision making mm-hmm. that we're into these days. Not saying, this is what we're going to do.
Sure.
We say, what do you want to do? And depending on their tolerance, their anxiety, their family history, the distance they traveled, all of these things, they make the decision.
But you're saying most say biopsy.
Oh, yes.
Oh, absolutely. I would for myself. I guess in my mind, you're right. It's the technology we have. You err on the side. The question is, you know, with those false positives, where you're talking about several thousand false positives that occur for every 10,000 women. That's concerning from a societal point of view. Is there a way that we can do better?
And can we? I mean, that's a great question.
Right. Lou said the critical thing, society point of view, if you're making a decision for a large community or an entire country and you're looking at the cost, it's one decision. Right. If you have a woman standing in front of you and they want to know whether they have cancer or not, and you can't tell them without doing a biopsy.
Isn't that why this is so hard to change?
Yeah,
because when you go from the macro to the micro, you know.
Right. See, I deal with individuals, as does Lou, but if you look at it from the society point of view, it is expensive. Now, the other problem we have is people expect a test to be 100%. Right. We're dealing with an imaging modality that at best is 85%, and the expectation is 100%. If you're a lawyer, you say, you missed this cancer on my patient, and I say, 85% is as good as we get.
Right.
There will be misses.
Right.
I think part of what Ava said, it reminds me of a conversation I had with a friend about where we send kids to school. And she said, you know what? On the broad level, everyone should send their, if you're involved and you care, send your kids to impoverished districts. Help them out. Get involved. Do that work. But then you've got one kid. You've got two kids. You look at them and you say, well, we can, but we also have to make other decisions too. It's easier to talk broadly. And then Gavis is saying, when you look at patient by patient by patient, maybe some of that.
You still have to work through with individual patients. But I think it's very important. What Avis is touching on is really important because patients seem to think it's a foolproof thing. It's the same thing. You could be the best driver in the world. You wear your seatbelt. You have an airbag. You're a defensive driver. Does that guarantee you won't get in a car accident? No, because there's going to be a percentage that you're not going to be able to control. And the question is, is there ways that we can reduce that percentage looking forward? We have the technology that we have now. We have good involved doctors that have discussions with patients, but they have that question in mind. Why do we have these false positives?
All right. So listeners, before I continue along then on this recent study, if you get any comments or questions, false positives or otherwise, it's a good chance for you to jump in here. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Now back to this study. Here's where I want to articulate what I think I read, and then I want you guys to tell me exactly where I'm wrong here, or at least if this is possible. So you've got false positives. And the study at least seems to be indicating to me that a person who gets a false positive may be more likely to be a person who eventually actually has cancer. Is that yes, Ava?
That is what the study said. And here's why we think it is. There's every mammogram is different and some are more difficult than others. And that's why we have this whole density discussion that's not for today. But if women are given sent a report to say your breasts are dense, and then there's a false positive added into that, and then maybe even a biopsy that ended up benign, those people in this huge survey did eventually, over the next 10 years, have an increased risk of breast cancer. So it's not the false positive that caused it, but the basic underlying breast tissue was such that it was the kind that might develop cancer. We think that maybe we'd add that into other risk factors like density, like family history, like all the other risk factors we know about, and then maybe you'd say also false positives, that for a reason that is difficult to explain but is genuine, there is a definite risk to those people in the future. So they really should just keep having their, don't run away, continue having your screening, and just an awareness. They're more likely not to get cancer, but they do have a slightly higher blip than the average person. Because of that false positive.
All right, so Dr. Papa, you're a data guy. Is this enough for you to start? I mean, like, what do you make of?
It depends because, you always like to see something like that, especially that's going to affect such a large part of population reproduce. Because one of the things you worry about is always patient selection. So you don't know that these individuals that are moving ahead and getting biopsies, as we were discussing just before the show, are these individuals that already have a heightened anxiety because there's a family history or there's been abnormalities in the past. So there's a certain selection bias that you worry about with any patient when you do these types of surveys or these types of studies. So you always in those type of things, you want to see some reproduction. And if you can develop a reasonable prediction tool, because prediction tools do help when you do have the patient in front of you. Because one of the things is it's not like a one size fits all. You really want to use every tool you can to help guide the patient, because you're going to have the patient that says, I don't know what to do. And you actually have to be a doctor and give them advice.
So we do have a tool that's actually in very common use. It's one of the commonest ways of measuring a lifetime risk of breast cancer, and it's called the GAIL model, G-A-I-L. Now, the GAIL model actually is a very simple device. It adds in the person's family history, so first-degree relatives, and whether they've had a biopsy or not. I can already tell if somebody's going to have a heightened risk on the GAIL model. If I see mother or sister had breast cancer, and they've had one benign, even a benign biopsy, plus one first-degree relative, does change in this calculation their lifetime risk. Right. So we do that calculation quite regularly because people will often want to know. And as we've maybe mentioned before, the high-risk people are 20%. Average women, 1 in 8, 12% lifetime risk. High risk is 20%. And so when we want to calculate, should this person get enhanced screenings, if you like, they should. We can do a calculation and give them our best estimate of their lifetime risk.
Okay. And so if the study, if it's reproduced, and if we, if it eventually sort of becomes, you know, just part of our general understanding of breast health, that if you get a false positive, you are at least more likely, and I, as Ava said, it doesn't mean you are likely to get cancer, you're going to get cancer, but if you're elevated in some way in terms of your risk for eventually getting cancer, Dr. O'Connell, do we know what about that person or what about their tissue, why that would be?
Generally, they've got denser tissue. They may deposit lots of calcium. I mean, it's mostly the dense tissue because we also know that increased breast density has an independent risk for developing cancer. Okay. I always say it's the double whammy. You're more dense and it's harder to find them. So those people are already at a higher risk. And now if we've biopsied it and even not found cancer, it really supports what you already said. It's difficult tissue to take care of.
All right. And Dr. O'Connell, just remind our listeners of the population. How many women are categorized as having dense tissue then?
Well, there are four categories of dense. It goes from fatty to scattered tissue, about 25. Fatty breasts have almost no dense tissue. Extremely dense has more than 75% dense, and it's a bell curve. 80% are in the middle. They're scattered density or heterogeneously. So at least 50%, we say usually about 50% of the population are categorized as dense.
And just more of a challenge. I mean, right now, but we're getting better? I mean,
we're better.
Technologically?
We're always looking for a better way to do. I mean, basically what we have is mammography. We supplement it with ultrasound, and we occasionally do MRI. Those are our tools. We try and get better and better mammograms, and then add ultrasound as needed. So we're always looking for a better way, but right now mammography is the gold standard.
Before I get back to the guidelines, just let me ask Lou, as someone who is both in the medical field and having had your wife go through what she's gone through, you kind of get it from different perspectives here. You know, do you see any obvious either changes or improvements, or sort of are we moving in a direction that satisfies you as a doctor and as someone whose family has gone through what they've gone through?
The best thing about something like this is the discussion. You know, there's always we have mammography and it is our gold standard. But you know, in my mind, you know, the goal is always to find a better way of screening women and to make sure that we personalize it, you know, using those prediction models, using family history. There are some individuals that, you know, may need much more enhanced imaging at a much earlier age compared to everybody else. So I think a key part of it is understanding your family history and always questioning, is there a way that we can do this better, looking for better modalities to try to reduce that false positive rate and develop better prediction tools and make sure those prediction tools are useful. Remember, they're prediction tools. It's like any other prediction tool. It's not 100%.
How often do your patients, people who you're working with, say, but wait, didn't the guidelines change? What did they say, 40, 50, what was
it? Well, I mean, if you look at the guidelines, in reality, they haven't really changed that much. I mean, what they're doing is they're trying to encourage physicians to involve the patient more in the discussion and the decision-making and taking into account, you know, their history and their preferences. So it's not just like, you know, here's the requisition, get your mammogram done. You know, trying to make it a little bit more of a discussion so there's not shock if there's a false positive and you have to pursue that. Or if they have a significantly high risk, that you may recommend that they do it earlier. So if you have, you know, if you have a 30-year-old woman has a very strong family history of breast cancer or even has genetic predispositions to it, your discussion with them is going to be very different. And their response may be, wait a minute, you're not supposed to start till I'm 40 or 50. That's the guidelines. That's to guide you what you would do with the general population. You have to individualize it.
Dr. O'Connell?
That is all very true. They are guidelines, not fast rules. But the one other thing wrinkle came up. The USPS Task Force, because the word US, United States Preventive Task Force, is meant to advise the government on what to pay for. The dirty subject of money has to come up. Because if the guidelines were enacted into law, then every woman would have to have their own coverage for screening from 40 to 50, and then only every 2 years from 50 to 74, and they'd have to pay for the other year. And over 74, they're on their own if they don't have insurance. But what happened in December was a law passed, an act went into law, a bipartisan of all things, in December, was tacked onto the big budget. And it said, because of the confusion, we are going to put a moratorium on any changes in coverage. The Affordable Care Act actually said that starting at age 40, if a woman turned up for a mammogram every year, it would be covered with no cost sharing, no copay. If the task force went into law, then that would not be so. They'd have to do copays and deductibles. To me, that's huge. And when the American Cancer Society came out with their guidelines, they clearly said the decision should have nothing to do with money. It should be based on fears, anxieties, risk factors, and all the other conditions, but that money should not be an issue. Because if you say to some woman, it's $200 to get your mammogram, listen, most people are going to say, I have no family history. I'll skip this year, or I'll skip forever until I, you know, come. So I think the danger is that women won't get screening that they might otherwise have chosen. So take the financial out of it, and then it's up to your family history, your doctor, your discussion, and your own fears and anxieties.
All right, so making sure I know where we stand now. Have we moved to at least take the money part of the decision
for
out?
2 years? For 2 years, there's a moratorium. So it's now going back to what Affordable Care Act, which said over age 40, if you turn up every year, it's covered once a year.
And that will hold for at least 2 years?
2 years, yeah.
So this year, 2017.
Yeah. And then we'll hear about it again.
And then we'll legislatively fight it out again?
Well, I don't know what's going to happen, but maybe, I don't know.
What do the insurance companies think about this?
Well, they'd love to not pay for it. It's all about money, you know.
I think what may happen is the big question. I mean, the U.S. Preventive Task Force is basically an objective way of looking at the data, and all they do is they report on the data, and they make the recommendations based on the data. There's always a public comment period. That's both physicians and the public that can comment on that, and there's a lot of gray zone in it. I think most insurance companies know it's a political third rail the mammogram. I mean, they know that. And if there's anything if there's any question that it's up in the air and you have discussion that says you should have a discussion with your patient from 40 to 50, which the U.S. Preventive Task Force says, that leaves it to just discussion for the patient and the doctor, which would make it very hard for them to say, you know, we're not going to cover it. The bigger concern that I have that I see is, you know, there are models of healthcare payment that are all high deductible, but they don't include any preventive services, and I can't get my patients to do anything because of the cost. You look at somebody who needs colon cancer screening, you're talking about several hundred dollars or thousands of dollars to get a colonoscopy done. So that's the bigger, you know, the other issue is as you shift the cost to the patient, how much of the cost you're going to shift the patient where it becomes detrimental to their health.
Dr. O'Connell?
Yeah, that's true. But the task force, the government has to pay for anything the task force gives a B rating or higher. They only gave a B to every 2 years from 50 to 74. And the concern is that, yes, if people have to pay or copay or deductible for their mammogram on the off years, they just will skip. And we know that the smaller the cancers we find, the better the treatment options are. And so we would prefer if people, I mean, if they can choose not to come, but it should not be about the cost.
And you mentioned this has been a bipartisan effort?
Yes, two senators.
Are you prepared to say something nice about a legislative body?
My goodness, two senators put up this law last August, and it was signed in December, and they both agreed that women should get the mammogram if they want it. Just a screening mammogram. We're not talking about ultrasound. We're not talking about anything else. But they can just get one mammogram once a year.
Okay. Yeah. Now, I'm going to incorporate some listener questions. Pamela just sent us a note. Sorry, we got a lot of papers here. Just wants to know, said, I'm 42 years old and I still don't know a good way to determine my own risk. You know, so determining your own risk, what are the factors? How do we?
Well, I think one of the best things to do is to go in and see your physician, whether it's your gynecologist, your primary care doctor, and to determine what your risk is. I think the idea of, you know,
all right, she's coming to you. Right. She's 42. Right. She's coming to you for the first time. Dr. Papa?
Right. So I would have that Gale model or some of the other models that are out there to kind of predict her risk over the next, you know, for over the next 10 to 40 years in terms of her risk for breast cancer, incorporating family history, whether she's had anything else in the past that is incorporated into that prediction model. And that'll help me give some meat on the bones to have the discussion rather than this gestalt idea.
Okay.
Well, my concern is, and I would be concerned, if a 42-year-old comes in and you say, look, I've looked at everything, no family history, blah, blah, don't get your mammogram. How about she gets a lump in the next year? And then she says, Dr. Papa, I've just read that 75% of women who get breast cancer have no risk factors apart from being women.
Right.
And that, to me, would be a concern. I'd say, look, the majority of women who get breast cancer do not have a family history or a risk factor, 75% or more. So you have to say to them, look, without any of that, you still could get it. We don't know.
But I'm not saying I would say you don't get the breast cancer. I mean, you don't get the screening. What I'd say is, this is what your risk, and then we discuss what her comfort level is.
Let her
decide. For some patients, they say, look, if my risk is low and my risk of dying from breast cancer is low and it's still unclear if you really save lives between 40 and 50, based on the data that's available, they may not want that.
But so long as they know that you might turn up with something and then you can't come back and say, why didn't you make me?
Right.
There's
no
making you anymore.
No, right. And I think that's why it's very important. There are still, let's be honest, there are still going to be patients that are going to say, you tell me what to do.
Oh, I know.
And that's part of it is that it's too overwhelming.
But that's okay, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, because I understand. And by the way, let me step back and say I'm really heartened to hear that the conversation really has become more inclusive. Not to say that as a patient, we're the experts, we're going to tell the doctors what to do, which probably drives you guys nuts sometimes. You know, sort of a partially educated person might be the most dangerous kind of patient. But at the same time, if you're saying we want you included in the decision, this isn't us dictating to you.
Right.
We want you to know the options. We want you to know the possible outcomes, and you are going to decide. But I can understand why some patients may say, I'm not qualified here.
Absolutely.
I'm going to let you make this decision. Right. And that happens, right?
Right. Absolutely happens. Absolutely. It happens all the time. And you take it that on a case-to-case basis. And you'd be surprised if you say to a patient, well, I want you to make the decision. You say, I think you should get the mammogram. Or you don't get the mammogram. They say, oh, well, I'm going to do the opposite. It kind of forces their hand to say, oh, they really did think about it and they really are convinced about what they want to do.
Dr. O'Connell?
Yeah, and I always have to say, well, of course, by the time they come to me, they've made the decision. But
right.
I mean, I really have to say that I see the people who do get cancer on the years they're not supposed to. 42-year-olds with cancer, it's like, if they wait, and they will say to me, I say, how do you feel about screening? If I waited to 50, I would not be doing very well. So, I mean, I see the people in their 40s who get it. So my bias is quite different.
Absolutely. I understand what you're saying. But the question also comes down to, and the big thing about the U.S. Preventive Task Force is in that age to 40 or 50, and this has been looked at over and over again, for years and years, it's still not clear that there's a big impact.
I have to say, though, we have to remember that 30% mortality reduction is a figure we don't have to debate. Statistics of deaths from breast cancer show that since the early 90s, that there has been a 30% reduction in mortality attributed to breast cancer.
Across the board.
Across the board. But we have to say that what's better? Is the treatment better? Of course it is. Is the detection better? Of course it is.
Absolutely.
So both of those things have driven this reduction in mortality, which is without no argument about it. So I think that something is working.
Right. But the question is not that. I don't think the task force said that there's no value to it, especially from 50 and above. The question is in that 40 to 50 age range, there needs to be a better way of selecting patients out.
I know, but from my point of view and from a lot of women's point of view, that 40 to 50 is an age that they're younger. They've got more going on. I mean, I'm the older person here, but I mean, a woman in her 40s with younger children and an awful lot going on, it's like we want to save their years. We talk about years of life lost. They have more years of life to lose than a woman in their 70s and 80s. So we feel like, why not give these people the best option of us finding it if we can?
Right, but the question is that it comes down to, in that, and I'm looking from a primary care point of view, is you want to save lives from breast cancer. That's not as clear in that age range.
You want to save lives, but you also want to reduce the number of times they have surgery, the extent of the surgery, the amount of radiation. So if you can find a teeny tiny pea-sized cancer in the breast and take it out before it goes to the lymph nodes, I think that most of it, we'd agree that that certainly changes their full life experience.
We assume that, correct.
Yeah. For some. Right. I mean, yeah, there are small cancers which are terribly aggressive and there are large ones which are indolent.
Right.
And I'm not talking about the extremes, but I think in general, we hope that the smaller, the better for our detection.
Okay. Let me jump in here and say, Bud and Irene waiting on the phones, we're coming to you in a second, but I just want to make sure before we move on past this point here, this goes back to some of that criticism that Dr. O'Connell and people in her field hear that all the time. From some of the critics who say we're over-treating cancer, right? That some of those small cancers are barely. But the argument you seem to be making is that we are not.
Well, no, there is overtreatment and overdiagnosis. So if somebody is 80 years old and they have a few specks of calcium that might be DCIS, it certainly could. That is the case where I would encourage them to watch it and wait it. You have to opt for the option of a biopsy or not, but it's not going to go crazy in 6 months or a year. So you could say that could be watched. But if you're a woman in your 40s and you have a little grouping of calcium, the chances are more that will go aggressive and become invasive, or it might be invasive already. So it depends on the age of the person and what their expectations are.
Okay, Dr. Papa, fair?
I think what's fair about it is you're right. There is overdiagnosis, but how do you tell which one's overdiagnosed?
Well, that's the other thing.
That's the big problem is that there's the issue about, so if you're 42 years old and you have a small speck of cancer, and this is one of the debates, is that something we really have to be concerned about? Who knows? So how are you going to err? Are you going to err? Well, I'll just leave it at 42 years old. There's very few women, I think, that would do that because of the potential years of life lost. And I think that's a very good point is, yes, there is overdiagnosis. And the question is, so how do we get better at it?
Well, you see, there's not overdiagnosis, there's diagnosis. Right. So we diagnose something and it's DCIS, stage zero, early, hopefully. And then the question is, we don't know. We feel that eventually, if you live long enough, this will become invasive. Well, if you're 80 years old, maybe we could watch. If you're 40 years old, it may take 10 years to become invasive. Well, you'll only be 50 then. So I think if you're in your 40s, we treat everything. And that's not should not be considered overtreatment. But I think if you're in your 80s and you have all kinds of treatment, that should be considered overtreatment.
It sounds to me, and again, this is where I hope you can correct me if I'm wrong. It sounds to me like this is kind of going back to the point that says, well, let's say we know, and I'm not talking specific numbers. I'm just going to throw numbers at a wall. Let's say we know that out of 100 diagnoses of women, say, in their 40s, who are diagnosed with what we would call, again, a small bit of cancer, et cetera, that... let's say studies show that 95 of those women, you don't need to treat sort of invasively. Right. But if you're 1 in 100 who's in a room with a doctor and he says, well, there's a 95% chance we don't need to treat this. Right. Are you not treating?
No, 95 is too, that's, no, it would not be 95.
Okay.
But I see what you're saying.
I'm just spitballing numbers, but the point being, when it comes to practical real life decision making, you might say that on balance and the macro, we know that it would be better. We would be the most efficient if we could somehow decide, the majority we don't treat and we only treat the ones that are going to become invasive. But what Lou seems to be saying is, how do you know?
Right.
Which
That's
becomes
exactly right.
sort of spreading, metastasizing,
right.
becoming a problem. Do you want to take that risk?
And a good example with this would be the prostate cancer issue in men. In men, it's the same type of thing. It was overdiagnosis. And there's been debate about even using PSA and screening men in general. For the same reason, older men, it's actually studies to show that it's more harmful to treat them. But it's the same type of questions. All cancers are not the same. Right now, yes, there probably is a sense of people who are being overtreated, whatever terminology you want to use. The question is, we don't have the technology to say, okay, you're in that 95%. You better get that 5% right.
Exactly.
There are some improvements, though. We now have decided that the younger the woman, the more we should treat. If somebody's got calcium and it's in a tiny speck, a half a centimeter, maybe not, but if it's 5 centimeters, then there's more going on. And the pathologists, when they look at it, there are some signs in the pathology to say that this is the bad, of DCIS, there's, if you like, a good DCIS, and then there's a worse kind. So the pathologists are helping us to determine. But right now, most women don't want to be told, we can watch this. The younger the woman, the more they say, do everything. I want to be here for my kids.
Sure.
Whereas if you're 80 or something and you're not feeling great, you'd probably say, no, it's okay, I'll watch it.
Absolutely.
And I totally agree with that.
Sure. And I think that's why, if I'm Dr. O'Connell's patient, I'd probably just end up saying, you just tell me what to do.
Now, there will be people will say, what is that 80-year-old doing coming in for their mammogram? Here's a huge issue that you're not going to look at this lovely 80-year-old who's full of life and everything and say, it's not worth you getting your mammogram because if you have cancer, you're going to die before. We can't do that. As long as somebody is healthy, and the number we've given is a 10-year reasonable life expectancy, you can look at some 80-year-olds and you say, they're going to be 100. So they should have their mammogram. Now, if you have somebody in their 50s who's a crock, you'll say, well, no. But I mean, my point being that if somebody is a healthy 80.
No, there's a healthy 80.
Absolutely.
And there's an unhealthy 45.
And the unhealthy, well, the unhealthy 80 should probably not come, but the healthy 80 should. So, but we're not telling people not to come.
I understand, yeah. So I'm going to get to your questions after this short break with Dr. Avis O'Connell, the Director of Women's Imaging and a Professor of Imaging Sciences at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and Dr. Lou Papa, a primary care physician at the Center for Primary Care, Olson Medical Group, and a Professor of Clinical Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center. You've seen Dr. Papa on Second Opinion and our related programs and answering your questions. So, Irene, Bud, we're coming to you. And if you want to call the program with your own questions on these issues, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Your questions next. I'm Evan Dawson, Monday on The Next Connections. We'll talk about climate change, and we'll talk about policies designed specifically to help mitigate climate change. There are four pieces of legislation right now that New York State is considering that could have an impact in various ways. We will work through all four, what you ought to know about them, and answer questions you might have. Fighting Climate Change with Policy, Monday on Connections.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Presidential campaigns have been slicing up voter groups for years. This cycle, the Ted Cruz campaign has been taking it to the next level, mining data about voters' personalities and behavior.
And I will apologize to nobody for using every tool we can to encourage Iowa voters to come out and vote.
Beyond micro-targeting later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That'll be this afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson in Fairport. This is Irene. Go ahead, Irene.
Oh, yes. Good afternoon. Great show.
Thanks.
I think a very important fact for all women to know is, do they have dense breasts? Because if they do, then they need to ask for the 3D mammogram. I recently had my screening mammogram, the 3D, at the Wendy Logan Breast Center, and it was recommended that I have an ultrasound because I have very, extremely dense breasts. And I did, not knowing if it was going to be covered by my insurance. But for peace of mind, I decided to go ahead and have it. And I wonder what the doctor's feeling is. If somebody has really extremely dense breasts, which has nothing to do with the size of your breasts, if they really need a screening ultrasound.
Thanks, Irene. Go ahead, doctors.
Right. Well, the point about the, first of all, the density is now an awareness thing. Since 2011, women are supposed to get a letter along with their results to tell them if they're dense or not. And indeed, if they are extremely dense, the options are to do the 3D, the tomosynthesis, or the ultrasound, but there's no guarantee this will be paid. So we have to have people sign that they agree, because unfortunately, the insurance companies have not agreed to cover this 3D. They say it's still investigational. Now, we think it's way beyond that, but women do have to agree to pay a little extra because it's not covered. And the state of Pennsylvania is going to make a rule soon that if somebody gets tomosynthesis, it's counted as their mammogram. So that's the tomosynthesis or 3D. The ultrasound is another point that there's no coverage for screening ultrasound as an automatic thing, and there will be co-pays and deductibles. It's not covered in the same way that a screening mammogram is. Now, we do sometimes think it's good to get that because the dense breasts are really hard to evaluate, but I think that you have to understand that there can be a charge. And so for peace of mind, a lot of women will do it, but that option is, you know, it can be expensive. If you have a high co-pay or a high deductible, it could be, you know, a couple of $100. So we can't tell who's going to have a tumor found during that. But the dense breast is a huge issue because you can't see everything in there.
Okay. That answer the question, Irene?
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the phone call. Appreciate that. In Rochester, this is Barb. Go ahead, Barb.
Hi. My question is incredibly timely. I just had this conversation with my daughter 10 minutes ago. We have a very, very strong history of breast cancer in my family. My mother and aunt died of it. I have cousins and my sister are all breast cancer survivors. I get MRIs and mammograms with ultrasound every year, but my daughter's doctor told her that she didn't have to start until age 35. And since our cancer is premenopausal, I thought that it seemed like it would be, you know, sooner than 35. So I wonder what your opinion is.
All right, stay on the line, Barb. Go ahead, Dr. O'Connell.
Okay, so the calculation for you was definitely probably a 20% lifetime risk. Somebody could do that same calculation for your daughter. If it comes to 20%, then your daughter would qualify for an MRI screening at any age. Usually we don't start mammography till 35, but the rule is usually you go 10 years earlier than the earliest person. So if somebody was 45, then you go 35, so that's that number. Now, if the first degree relative happened to be 40, you might actually start at 30. So we tend to move the mammography a little earlier, depending on what the family history was. But the calculation is still good for the MRI screening. It's considered high risk if it hits 20%.
Excellent. The earliest that I know of is age 48.
So 38, so 35 would be good. The ultrasound option is often offered to people who don't quite qualify for the MRI, but they feel strange doing nothing. If their doctor orders, they can't just walk in and order it themselves, but if their doctor orders a screening ultrasound, it will go through their insurance, though it's not 100% covered, and they could have a screening ultrasound if they request it.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Barb.
That information. Thank
yeah,
you.
Good luck to you and your family. Thank you very much for the phone call, Barb. The highest possible individual risk is what number, Avis?
Well, over 20% is, I mean, highest could be 30%, could be 50% if they have the BRCA gene. It could be even higher than that, but that's a whole different discussion. We consider people high risk if it's 20%, but it could be way higher. The BRCA gene, which is only something like 5% of the population, very small number, but the BRCA gene has higher than 20%, and they will get annual mammograms and annual MRIs. I might say right now that if you're getting an annual MRI, you don't need the ultrasound as well. The mammogram for sure, and if you're getting the MRI, the ultrasound's really not necessary.
Okay.
Save some money there.
Bud and Chilai. Go ahead, Bud.
Hello. Well, surprise. Since I left Kodak, I've been doing patent, you might say, placement services for people. And one that I had was from Syracuse University. And then after I had talked with Dr. Wendy Logan, who was very excited about this, it turns out that Syracuse decided to market their own patents. Now, I want you to jot this number down. This is the patent that is the start of it all. US 613-7896A.
Why am I writing this down, Bud?
Because if they want to find out what Syracuse University is doing, and they're doing a lot, they have a whole study underway, as does the U of R. But this one here takes and looks at existing mammograms and greatly reduces the false positive. It's called Geber filtering for improved microcalcification in digital mammograms.
So you're breaking a little news for us, Bud. Is that what you're saying?
This is a patent. I want them to look. I can't make any money off this because they cover their own patents now.
Okay, well.
But if you look up that patent and you contact Syracuse University, you will be able to talk with the people that are doing this. It actually is using CAD systems to do it. They also already have it. And so what we were going to do with Dr. Logan was to take old digital mammograms and actually test them and compare what this thing found versus what the actual, results on the patient found.
All right, well, Bud, let me just break in there and say, you know, I don't know where we're going with that exact patent or that number and that alphabet soup that you gave us, but I will say that it's an interesting sort of point in the discussion, doctors, about where we're going in terms of the quality of technology and false positives and et cetera. And so I don't know if you have any thoughts about where we go next year. Or are we on the cusp of, you know, something sort of more effective?
Well, you know, from a primary care perspective, you know, we're always skeptical. There's always been promises of things that would come along that are better, and nothing has been as good as mammogram. That's our gold standard.
Well, the CAD does. We all do use these CADs
right.
for finding calcium. I mean, 85%, I think, is the number of mammograms have calcium.
Right.
We don't usually have trouble finding the calcium, but the CAD highlights the calcium, we can zoom in and see, are these the good kind or the bad kind? Because everybody's got some kind. Right. So it's anything that's helpful. But if they could, if the CAD could tell us that this calcium is cancer calcium versus benign fibrocystic calcium, that would be the day. But I think that's going to need contrast enhancement and other things. But anything, we look at all new technology, and we're always trying to find a better way.
But it's going from the point where you have, okay, the patent and saying we have some promising results to applying it to the population is a huge leap. Because there's been many things that have come along and says, this is going to be a thing that's going to solve the breast cancer screening. And nothing has really done much better than mammography.
So far, no.
Right.
All right, Kate in Rochester, next step. Go ahead, Kate.
Hi, Evan. I had a question, well, actually more of a comment that I was hoping I could put out there and have your guests respond to if they'd like. I think when we hear about cancer, we often focus more on the cure. Especially with the Susan G. Komen Foundation, there's Walk for the Cure, it's Fight for the Cure. But there's not much questioning of the cause of cancer, at least from what it seems to me. And I'm wondering if that's because science and people in general tend to see the body as more of a closed system. And there's not much thought about how the body responds to environmental factors. And there are a lot of toxins and waste that we do sort of have ingrained in our bodies. And I was just wondering if our efforts and our thoughts that focus now on the cure for cancer might be somewhat misguided.
A very interesting question, Kate. And Dr. Papa, you want to weigh in first?
Well,
stay on the line, Kate. Right. This is a very interesting question. Go ahead, Dr. Papa.
I mean, I think, from a primary care point of view, we're always interested in something like that. The problem is causative agents are really difficult to study. You really need large populations. And unfortunately, there's a lot of built-in bias in those type of studies. So it makes it very difficult to say it's definitive. And more so because it's multifactorial. What we're finding is, in the 70s, we say, oh, there's this causing cancer. It's not that simple. It's usually a series of events that lead to the diagnosis of cancer. So I think people do look at that. I mean, I can tell you that we, there isn't, a six-month period that doesn't go by that there isn't a paper that says there is this association between XYZ cancer and this particular compound or environmental agent. But the question is it usually definitive enough to say it's causative rather than it's an association? That's the big problem, because you'd have to make huge changes for that. And then there's very often conflicting articles that don't show that. So it's a very hard area to study, because there usually isn't a thing. There's usually a series of things, and it makes it even harder to kind of tease out, which one is which. So I think the focus on the cure is there because that's at least something we can do for people that have that. You see the focus on the cure to help people that have that. Finding the actual causative agent is always so much harder.
Dr. O'Connell?
Well, I would say that we focus on detection, and then we have our team of oncologists for the cure and surgeons. But let me say that this is something that we have to keep reminding people. There are only two known causes of breast cancer. One is being female and the other is getting older. So since, 1% of cancers are in males, so the other 99% are female, and the average age of diagnosis is about 63, and the older a person is, the more likely anything we see on the mammogram, a bit like prostate in men, the older a woman lives, the more likely they are to get some level of breast cancer, be it DCIS or invasive. So they're the only things we know. But having said that, we all, the usual healthy prevention discussions come up, and overweightness is one, over alcohol, the usual thing, not too much alcohol, not too much food, good active, active lifestyle. Those actually all do have minor, there's not one of them that works, but it's kind of like what your mother and father told you, moderation in all things and a healthy lifestyle. And that's all we can offer. I mean, there are chemical prevention agents, but we don't give them to the average person. So yeah, being female and getting older, the only two we can really put our finger on right now.
Kate, you want to follow up there?
No, not really. I think, that's just, it's good to hear that it's more of a an ease issue. I guess what's the funding like then? So is there much funding going into cure-based intervention? And then how does that compare to sort of primary intervention. I don't know if you can speak to that also, but that's something that I would like to follow up with.
All right, Kate, thanks very much. Thanks for the phone call. Dr. Papa?
I don't know how much of the funding goes into prevention, which is the area that Avis works in, versus even before that, identifying, you know, other risk factors, or whether it's, you know, toxins in our food or a better prediction model. That all kind of fits under the same umbrella. I think there's funding across the board in all those areas. A lot of the funding does go into the treatment and the cure because that tends to be more expensive. But, you know, there's funding across the board. I don't know the breakdown of what percentage goes into what, though.
Again, not knowing the numbers, but there's a huge amount of money and a huge amount of research into breast cancer at all levels, pre, during, mm-hmm. after. Lots of money in it. So, I mean, I think I'm sure we're not aware of any actual huge. It would be a huge investigation. You'd need millions of people. You'd have to control them for one factor, like for height and weight.
There's so many variables.
But I mean, there's no question. There's an awful lot of money in breast cancer research, which is good. Something will come out of it eventually if there's something there that we need to know.
I think, as Lou said, you know, we do occasionally tend to swing back and forth with causative and this is or this isn't, and I suspect when it comes to medical research, I'm sure we'll get better. More time we get better, bigger trials, bigger sample sizes. But stripping away variables, I mean, we still don't exactly know all the mechanisms of migraine, for goodness sake.
Right. No, true. Attributing causation is very difficult. Unless you have a clear smoking gun, like, you know, cigarettes with lung cancer, it makes it very difficult to identify the multiple causative agents.
Okay. Now, you mentioned pre-screening. I wanted to ask just a quick question about pre-cancer as a term. Pre-cancer, Dr. O'Connell?
Well, DCIS is considered stage zero. So cancer is a continuum. When we do biopsies, we will get findings from what we call hyperplasia, which is the cells are a little busy, to atypia, which is they're not quite normal, to DCIS, which is ductal carcinoma in situ, or lobular carcinoma in situ. There is a continuum. So you might say that atypia is a pre-cancer, and some people would say DCIS, it's pre-invasive, it's still confined to the ducts. So it depends on your definition, but there is a grade that the cells go through, and every time we see invasive cancer, we usually see a little DCIS nearby. So the suggestion is that we don't know the timeline, but we do feel that the cells go from hyperplasia to atypia to in situ to invasive, but the timeline is what we don't know.
But pre-cancer, I guess, again,
one of those.
DCIS, right?
Well, atypia might be considered pre-cancer.
But it is,
because it's
pre-cancer. It is or is not a domino on the way to cancer, definitely.
We use the term we think that it's a progression, but we don't know how quickly it happens, that there is a progression, but it doesn't always happen. It could stop at DCIS and never progress. Non-obligate precursor is the fancy word. So that there is usually atypia and DCIS where there's invasive, but where there's atypia, there isn't necessary, you know, it won't always progress. So it's very tricky there.
Pre-cancer is the holy grail. If you can kind of detect the cancer before it becomes cancer is the best situation. Like the best example of pre-cancer and how well it works is in cervical cancer and is in colon cancer. Those are two areas where we know the pathology and the biology of that cancer, that pre-cancer, you know, whether it's, you know, changes in the cervix from HPV or it's abnormal polyps in the colon, we know there's a march that occurs to cancer. And that has a huge impact. The key thing is making sure that you have the right pre-cancer, that it's leading to a more invasive form most of the time, like it does in cervical. Because look at the impact that has had in cervical cancer and colon cancer. It's an enormous impact if you can get to the precancerous stage.
See, that's where people think that we should relabel DCIS and call it precancer. Like the cervical cancer used to be called carcinoma in situ of the cervix. Now it's called severe dysplasia. Well, if we change the phrasing or the terminology, the DCIS is a precancer, but we're not sure how quickly it might change and if it always changes in the timeline of the person's life. So there is a move afoot to say maybe DCIS shouldn't have the C word. It shouldn't be called carcinoma in situ if it's pre-cancer. So that's another discussion, probably not for today.
Okay. Eric sends a rather lengthy email about the way cancer is treated and detected. He said, I understand your guests have said that we still haven't found anything better. But he said he's someone who believes that nanotechnology is where we're going in the future of cancer treatment. And that, you know, Dr. O'Connell's looking at me going, I'm not an expert in nanotechnology. Is that what that little
That's
reaction
what that means,
to that?
Yeah.
Don't ask me any nanotech.
For once, I have no comment.
I know this is not a nanotech panel. I think Eric is just saying he is hopeful that eventually, it's a long email. He essentially says he is hopeful that whether it's nanotech or something else, that eventually we can treat cancer by killing the bad without destroying so much of what is good.
People have been working on that for 50 years.
So that's just another one of what you said is...
Right. There are incredibly...
We'll get there eventually. Yeah.
Right.
Don't you think we will?
There are incredibly smart people have dedicated their entire lives to this that are looked at every aspect of that. That, you know, they put in 18-hour days to try to figure this out. I mean, they're incredibly dedicated. It's gone from where we used to treat cancer as one big bad... agent in our lives, to realizing that it's multifaceted, that they're not all the same, that they march at different rates. We have a much better understanding. Nanotechnology may or may not help, but the reality is understanding the biology and understanding the individual biology, I think, is going to be probably one of the biggest things to kind of, you know, help us battle this.
Sure. And only because looking at human history and science and progress, I suspect at some point, we absolutely, Eric's right, whether it's nanotech or something else, we will be able to treat cancer without destroying the good to kill the bad. I don't know if it's in our lifetimes, but don't you think it? Wouldn't you be surprised, Davis, if in the human history timeline,
absolutely,
we never got better than we are now?
Well, as Lou says, there's an awful lot of brain power being used to get this right. We're all very hopeful.
Okay. And let's not forget, you know, we forget that we've done remarkably well with cancer. I mean, if you look at, the age-adjusted death rate from cancer, it's actually dropping. It's really remarkable the impact that we've had on cancer. And there's some remarkable treatments out there for cancers that we've had no impact on in the past, where we're actually seeing long-term remissions, which make people think of things like cures. I mean, it is kind of a remarkable age.
All right. Well, our thanks to our guests for the hour, Dr. Lou Papa, a primary care physician at the Center for Primary Care, Olson Medical Group, and a professor of clinical medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Papa, always a great conversation with you. Thank you so much for being here.
Always glad to be here, Evan.
And Dr. Avis O'Connell, director of women's imaging, not a professor of nanotechnology, but she does all kinds of other things. She's a professor of imaging sciences at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Avis, always great to see
Thank
you.
Thank you.
I didn't demote you. You're not a professor of nanotechnology.
I'm not a professor.
but I always enjoy the conversation with Avis because I think it's easy to see a headline, to see a news report, and it's a common theme on the show. We don't always do a great job. I've struggled myself as a journalist at times to kind of report it accurately. So Avis and Lou do such a great job for us in helping frame it, helping us understand it, and answering your questions. You've had a lot of great questions today. Thanks for joining the program all week long. Thank you to John Andrus, the engineer today, Megan Mack, producer. And thank you for listening. I'm Evan Dawson, and I will talk with you Monday on member-supported public radio.